This, everybody,
That was
listen
nuts.
up. Get your ears on. This is a really important episode. This is really
You've seen the
great.
title.
Yeah, you clicked on it for a reason.
You
If you
clicked on
didn't
it
and you're like,
and
who the
you
heck
know
is
it's
Scott
about.
Rao? You're about to find
Get
out.
your ears ready.
Lock in.
Ears open, guys.
Here's a brief explanation. Scott Rao is a coffee professional. He is coffee. He's a consultant. He
He
is an
is the
author.
coffee.
He is one of the biggest names in coffee, one of the biggest pioneers of specialty coffee, the GOAT, the man himself, the wizard. He basically is Dumbledore.
Of specialty coffee. He's fantastic. I never thought within the first year of Sidecar, now year two, that we would be talking to him. It's fantastic. The conversation went well.
I'm really happy with how it
Listen
turned
up.
out, but yeah, listen up, guys. We're gonna be talking about Scott. We're gonna be talking about his business ventures. We're gonna be talking about specialty coffee, getting into specialty coffee, a little bit of roasting stuff, and what's
Ooh.
next. So yeah, lock in here. We appreciate you guys for clicking on the episode. It's a good one.
Yep.
Sidecar out.
Sidecar up.
All right. Welcome
All right.
everybody. Yeah, right. Welcome everybody to another episode. My name is Lewis.
And I'm Caleb.
And this is the Sidecar Coffee Podcast. Today we have a very special person today. We have the man himself, Scott Rao.
Hey guys, nice to see you.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, starting off this episode, we're going to be drinking a coffee from Prodigal Coffee Roasters. This coffee is a honey process from Colombia. It is a Flor de Cana Pink Pabon. And yeah, we got a sidecar pulled. Caleb, while I take my drink of this espresso, you want to explain what a sidecar is?
Yeah, for those who don't know and those who don't care, a sidecar is two drinks at the same time. We have a small milk beverage. It can be any milk beverage of your choice, espresso based, of course. Then we take that same espresso and we serve it on the side by itself. That's the sidecar. It's a great way to taste how milk affects coffee and how awesome coffee can be. So, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a cool thing. We like it a little bit. But which one did you go with? Espresso first?
Yeah, I did espresso first, and it just kind of is like this super sharp fruitiness, nice strawberry, good pink notes, but it also has like some good sweetness. Mine
Yeah.
was delicious. I did kind of a longer ratio, I think closer to like a 2.5 to 3, but it turned out really, really good.
Yeah, this is it's just strawberry, like strawberry everything. A lot of really good sweetness on the finish, almost like sugar cube, but it's very refreshing. Like it's not one that lingers. Yeah, that's nice. I'm excited for milk. I actually have not tried this one with milk yet, so
I
we'll see.
so for me it surprisingly well in milk. I think it brought more sweetness out, but you still have a lot of it's like almost like pink Laffy Taffy, like kind of like I don't know. That's how I would describe it. Or almost like the finish is kind of like saltwater taffy like, but
Yeah,
I think
that's
it does great. I was expecting a little bit of sourness, which is, but it's slightly there, but not as much as I thought really.
No,
Especially because,
that's clean.
yeah.
But yeah,
But yeah, fantastic coffee.
Scott, to start things off, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a little herbal tea. I just went through my I'm in Melbourne right now, so it's 10 a.m. I just had my two cups of coffee. I went out
Sweet.
for a coffee to a friend's roastery and then came back to my hotel and made a cup of washed geisha from Prodigal.
Nice.
From Prodigal.
What's
Do you want to
your
talk?
travel setup? I just want to ask really quick. What does that look like?
So I've got a onesie presso hand grinder. I've got a hoop, and I've got a little pitcher for the hoop to sit on, and a digital scale, and it all fits in a gallon Ziploc bag, and that's it. Very, very low
Sweet stuff.
maintenance.
Yeah.
The hoop's nice for
Nice.
travel because it doesn't require a special kettle or anything
Yeah.
like that. And once you
Yeah.
leave the U.S., every hotel room in the world has a hot water kettle, so
Damn
that's always
U.S.
easy.
Those, yeah, those
And
U.S.
honestly,
guys.
Melbourne water right out of the tap, the alkalinity is slightly low, but the water is pretty clean, low TDS. They don't put much chlorine in the water here. Every time I leave the U.S. and come back to the U.S., all I taste is chlorine if I drink a
Yeah.
cup of water.
Yeah,
So
wow.
actually, even with straight tap water in Melbourne, the coffee comes out pretty good.
That's awesome. I'd love to hear it.
That's really nice. Wow. So, and then before we get really started, do you want to talk a little bit about this Floridicana pink bourbon?
Sure. It's a honey processed pink bourbon. We tend to buy very clean, pretty, fruity coffees. We try to avoid anything that you might call funk. I'd like to say that, we're pretty good at that as far as getting things that are extremely fruity, fruit forward, very expressive coffees, but try to avoid the over fermenty, the funky, the boozy, all that kind of stuff. And this coffee slots right in. I mean, it's got some nice like honey, even though, I mean, it's not the processed honey that I should say. The process honey process does not make coffee taste like honey necessarily. It just happens to be that this coffee has a little bit of a honey flavor.
Yeah,
You mentioned
agreed.
strawberries.
Yeah.
There's sometimes a little bit of like a candy acidity, a little bit like pineapple.
Yes.
It's really lovely coffee. I don't know anything else I can tell you about it.
I mean, yeah, it's really great. That candy sweet like acidity that it has, it's just so, I don't know. It's one of those, it doesn't linger. You go back for more. And I also like notice it's one of those that just brews itself. Like there, you really don't have to, even if you get a little under extraction, a little over, it's still super nice. So yeah, let's get into it, Lewis. Do
Let's
the
do it.
honors.
All right. Well, I guess let's start with, who is Scott Rao?
So I got into coffee right after university. I opened my first cafe when I was 22 in 1994.
Wow.
I had a crazy adventure where I had been living in California and I decided it was a lot more competitive in California at the time than it was in other parts of the country. So I decided to pack up all my things, drive across the country, look for investors and look for a place to put a coffee shop, because that would work. And it actually did in a funny way. So I visited all these university towns along the way and ended up in a place called Amherst, Massachusetts, which was a town of about 30,000 people. I opened my first cafe in 1994, and it was a wonderful place to put a cafe. It was extremely successful. We were a little bit ahead of our time in terms of roasting a bit lighter and doing things a little bit different than, say, sort of the second wave things that existed at the time. And then over the years, I've owned a cafe in Montreal. I owned another cafe in Massachusetts. We roasted in two out of those three cafes, and I own a part of a company in New York called Regalia and Multimobile, which is a roastery and a co-roasting space. And now I own Prodigal in California with my friend Mark. I'm sorry, in Colorado with my friend Mark. And along the way, I've been doing some consulting over the years, writing books, consulting, and just kind of mixing it up, doing some seminars, trying to keep things interesting.
So getting
Yeah,
into
awesome.
coffee that young, were you always kind of like, I want to open my own business, I want to travel, I want
Yes.
to work in the
Yes.
service industry?
When I was a teenager, at any point, if you said, "What do you want to do with your life?" I would say, "Oh, I'm gonna open restaurants or some sort of food business." And then I didn't like coffee because truly, I hadn't had a good coffee at that time. I mean, it was quite hard to find. And then when I was 21, a coffee shop opened near my apartment, and I tried their coffee, and I was shocked to find that I liked coffee, like that I liked good coffee. And the guy who owned the shop, his name is James. He's still a dear friend, and he
That's
became sort
awesome.
of a mentor for me. I would go to his shop every day and have coffee, and I was still just every day just shocked that I liked coffee because everything I'd had before was bitter, burnt, vile in some way, and his coffee was delicious. And he was sourcing pretty carefully. He was roasting a lot lighter than most others back then were roasting, and so it really influenced me. But yeah, I definitely planned to open food businesses my whole life. And I still constantly think about, I'll walk in a gelato shop or something. I'm like, I should open a gelato shop. Just like can't help that little bug of like it's always exciting starting a business. So
So,
yeah.
yeah.
this is kind of what kind of draws you to that, you think? Is like the service side of things, or just like wanting to, like, what kind of.
I think some combination of I've always been entrepreneurial. I mean, I was that kid in sixth grade who was hatching plans to make money. I was running little side businesses in school. I had a I had a math tutoring business that I actually made quite a bit of money in my last year of high school. I've always been doing that kind of thing, and I love business. I loved math growing up, and I love food. And so for me, it was natural. We'd go to restaurants when I was a kid, and I'd look around, and I'd just be wanting to understand how that business worked and what the finances were. And it was just a natural interest for whatever reason. You know, some kids get into one thing, some get into other. I don't know, but it was.
What was the first cafe you opened in that scene in the 90s, the coffee scene? I assume much different than what it is now. I mean, I don't know.
So
I wasn't there.
we were open every day, 7 a.m. to midnight.
Oh,
We were
wow.
in a university. We were in a university town. We got quite busy.
Okay.
We were doing about 1,200 people a day by year four. And it was a struggle to convince people to drink good coffee. So people would come in. The most common things they would ask for would be French roast, hazelnut, or Colombian. Now, nothing wrong with Colombian. I love Colombian coffee, but you know, the gist was they had no idea why they should buy a Kenya. And when I would suggest, oh, we're doing Kenya on batch right now, they'd be like, no, I just want regular coffee, right? And so that was the mentality back then, was I want dark, or I want flavored. I just don't, what really what people didn't want was they didn't want weak diner coffee, right? Diners at the time would use about no joke, like a 30-to-1 ratio in their batch brews, and they would grind pretty fine,
Fire.
and they would try to get strength by extracting the crap out of less grounds. And people didn't want that, but they didn't understand that this thing they did want came in many varieties. So it was, you know, it took a long time, a lot of talking, a lot of trying, you know, a lot of convincing, and over time we got a very loyal following. The fourth year I was open, Starbucks decided to open in my tiny town in a location kind of plopped right in front of me. And one of my favorite conversations of my life was their regional director. I came to the shop to say hello, and he basically said, oh, you know, don't worry, there's plenty of room for this for both of us in this town. And I was like, no, there's not. You're never going to make money here. And sure enough, they never did. They never even broke $1,000 a day revenue for the next few years while I was there, because they just didn't get how powerful of a business and a connection with our customers we made. And you know, a small town supporting kind of the local hero is not that interested in supporting the chain above that. And that was, you know, I was slightly concerned when they came in, but ultimately they got no traction. But it's, you know, it took 4 years of really working on people to convince them that, you know, what we're doing is, you know, quite good. And then once we got them trained on good coffee, they weren't going back to diner coffee or Starbucks or anything else.
That's insane. I feel like doing that at such a young age, and you know, both of us are 23, so
Scott,
it's
the Starbucks killer.
yeah, right?
Yeah,
So
right.
starting a roastery that young, was that like a huge, how were you opening that with someone else that had roasting experience, or did you just jump right in?
Nope, I
Oh,
jumped right
man.
in. I had, yeah, I would say I wasn't necessarily that mature, but I was very responsible and very analytical about stuff. I was probably a pretty terrible manager at the time. I mean, I definitely, you know, had to learn how to manage people, which at 22 is very difficult. I definitely knew how to work hard. I knew how to run a business from the point of view of, you know, the controlling costs and, you know, making sure that we were delivering consistently good service and product. I had a lot to learn, but I was willing. I really genuinely did. I mean, people, every once in a while you meet someone who's like, oh, I work 100 hours a week. And that's not true. Very few people in the world work 100 hours a week, because to work 100 hours a week means you do absolutely nothing but work and sleep, and you better be insanely physically fit to survive that. And but I actually did. I did work 100 hours a week for about 5 years. I never went to the movies. I never went to a restaurant. I never took a day off. And I was very, very physically fit back then, and I was exhausted all the time. And but I was willing to do whatever it took to, you know, make sure that we could be profitable and survive. And I felt like that was my one chance in life. If you open a business at 20 something and you borrow money and take on an investor and stuff and you fail, like you may not get another chance.
With all of that, what's kind of, Is it the business side of thing that's motivating you, or are you like slowly following and falling in love with like the process of coffee, or is it kind of like a mixture of both?
It's definitely both. I mean, the coffee excited me a lot. I mean, once I found out that I liked coffee, I got very excited about coffee, and then I dove right in. And I would sometimes work till midnight and then stay behind after closing to spend a couple of hours do some experiments to kind of understand coffee better. Right. I was really into learning about coffee. But of course, making money, paying people back, becoming financially independent, those were also very important and necessary.
So
Yeah.
after opening this place in was it Massachusetts? You moved across the world?
So I sold the business after 7 years, and I took a few years off to travel. I traveled all over the world, traveled all over the US, went to Europe, went to South America, went to Australia, New Zealand, really fell in love with New Zealand. It's quite a beautiful place. Ended up staying there for a couple of years, and I got very inspired by the coffee culture in Australia and New Zealand because they were better at making espresso and milk beverages than we were in North America. And they really didn't make filter coffees. They were very laser focused on making high volume of espresso beverages very well. So I learned a lot there. Definitely got inspired by that. And also they were very good at, and they still are very good at, having both excellent food and excellent coffee in the same business. And that's kind of a rarity in the US. We tend to be kind of good at one thing at a time. And so I came back to the US mostly because a guy I knew wanted to open a business and get my help. And so we opened what you could sort of describe as half French bistro, half coffee roasting slash cafe. Hard to explain, but ultimately became a very successful business. We would do a lot of breakfast and lunch or brunch, and we would also have a coffee bar, and we had a 23 kilo got hot in the corner, and we kind of, kind of divvied it up where I focused very hard on the coffee side, and the chef focused very hard on the food side, and we tried to do both very well. Actually, that place is still there, still standing many years later.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's super cool. What?
So, what's the place called?
It's called Esalon. It's in Hadley, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Went back to
It's a
Massachusetts.
busy place. They're probably doing a little over 2 million a year now, just doing, breakfast, lunch, coffee.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
Gotcha.
it's a great place. Yeah.
So diving into, so being a manager on the and opening up all of these places, are you, were you always kind of involved with, or you liked more of the roasting side, coffee science side, less of the bar side of things, like when it comes to being a barista and making drinks and designing a menu and stuff?
To me, roasting was more of a necessity, but I always enjoyed making beverages more. And I made, I worked behind a bar more than full time at every place, and I did most of the roasting. And so I was very involved. And at all of the cafes that I've owned, I've always done a fair amount behind the bar. Because that's, to be honest, most of us who get into coffee get into it because we really enjoy making coffee, or you really enjoy hospitality or something. And then maybe one day you get into sales or admin or roasting or something else. But usually what draws you to the business is you like making coffee. And I never really wanted to stop making coffee because that was really the fun part.
Yeah, that's cool to hear, actually. I feel like a lot of roasters have either like no, or most baristas don't have any experience with the roaster, and the roaster has no experience with the barista. Kind of cool to
Which
hear.
I mean, and that doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, it's
Yeah, 100%.
as long as
100%.
both respect what the other one does, and
Yes.
tries to understand, where to draw the line, what influences what. I would say I own three cafes outright, and I helped start a couple of others, but by the third cafe, I had made 1 million coffees with my own hands at one point or another. And I probably roasted 50,000 batches myself. And then, by now I've tasted another 40, 50,000 with clients. So, definitely a fair amount of experience on both sides.
100%. That's
And
crazy.
so going on, you open three cafes, you're roasting. To what degree, like as a roaster, were you kind of I guess pushing roasting to the next level, pushing coffee into specialty coffee, and really trying to push lighter roast and green sourcing and all that.
So I would say, from an evolutionary sort of perspective, in the 90s, I really had no idea how to influence the roasts other than going lighter or darker. And we didn't really have the tools. Most roasting machines back then had, at most, the equivalent of the dial that you have on your home gas stove, as far as controlling the gas level. Nothing was really digitized until the 2000s. There really wasn't data logging software. So most roasters, myself included, felt like, well, I'm using the same inputs every time, but I'm not really getting the same result every time, and I don't know why. And I would say around the time that data logging software came out is where, the struggle to get better sort of hit an inflection point, and then it became a lot easier to know where the cause and effect was, or what at least what moves seemed to correlate with quality. And then it got easier and easier to say, oh, okay, I want to roast lighter, but I don't want to underdevelop. I mean, in the 90s, if I just roasted lighter, at some point I would have just been underdeveloping because I didn't know what to do to be able to roast lighter without underdeveloping, right? And so, but it really took the software, the visuals, the curves, the data collection to be able to start putting the puzzle together. And, made a lot of mistakes along the way, but there was, two steps forward, one step back kind of thing over time, where there were a lot of aha moments as far as, oh, okay, this seems to correlate with better development. This seems to be moving us in the right direction. So.
I think that kind of a lot of roasters say, like it's just the constant two step forward, one step backwards, and like that sort of like same thing that we talked to is in that direction. And do you think for people that are for roasters that are just now starting, do you like what kind of advice do you think you would have for roasters that are looking to get into specialty, talking about you opening that place and convincing people that this is the type of coffee that they want? What's your kind of approach on that? Because I think for specialty coffee, a lot, even just us talking to our friends, is like, try this coffee, and people like, how do you get people interested and bought in on specialty coffee, I guess?
So, a few things. Well, there's a lot of questions in there. If you're getting into roasting, I would say the absolute best thing you could do would be to find someone who knows what they're doing, who you could work for. That's not always easy or possible, but if that is possible, do it, because you'll be, even if you're getting paid minimum wage, do it, because this is about learning. This is about getting experience, and not doing it while your entire bank account is on the line. You might fail, kind of thing, right? As far as, okay, sorry, you mentioned a few things. You were like, well,
Yeah, I
someone's
did.
getting into roasting.
Sorry.
Sorry,
I
sorry.
started talking and then I was like, oh, this could be another thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
Anyway, yeah.
I think first where to start is, like, if you're a roaster, and let's say, just because from where we met and where we started working to meet, the town that we were in is not a town that's very interested in specialty coffee. And it seems like you started in a town very, very similar. And so being working in the company, and because I eventually went on to do roasting, and we did not have the software. We did not have, we were on a 10 kilo Proster from like 2009. And so I was just roasting by color, basically. And then, but for roasters who are just now getting in saying, I want to do specialty, where's the good starting point for them?
So, okay. So going back, number one, working for someone with experience that they know what they're doing is critical. Number two, you asked a little bit about how do you sort of convert people or move people toward, appreciating what we do. Look, if I visit my mom and I make her a cup of the lightest, fruitiest coffee I have, she's not gonna like it. She might pretend to like it, but she doesn't like it. Okay. Now, but I know that if I mix in 50% of that with 50% of, say, what we call our milk espresso blend, which isn't dark, but it's mellower, right? I know she's like, oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty interesting, right? And I know that over time, I can sort of cut in 40% of that espresso blend, and then a year later, cut in 30% of it, and sort of gently. Coffee is all about acquired taste.
Yes.
So don't do the thing people do where someone says, "Oh, I like Starbucks," and you say, "Oh yeah, here's this light roast. It's better." It's not going to work, right? It's not that it's not better. I mean, to you and me, it's just that that person's palate needs time and experience to adapt. And it can't. Everyone can. I mean, I've had Italian friends who eventually got used to light roasts and very fruity coffees. It just took a while, right? Because their palate had been trained on darker and, various proportions of Robusta and espresso, and then to eventually like light roast filter coffee is kind of a miracle. But it takes time, right? So I would say, just wherever you are, right? If you're in some small town and people aren't that especially whatever, you kind of have to meet them where they are, and you have to guide them. You can't just get frustrated that they don't see the world the way you do. It's a little bit like having a political argument with someone. If you just take two opposite positions and just yell at each other, you will get absolutely nowhere, right? If you take the time to listen, to understand, find some common ground, soften the conversation a bit, you might actually move one or both of you a little bit closer together, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And then with kind of your career and like as you progress through everything since, how were you, when did you kind of grab onto teaching, consulting, doing blog posts and like diving deeper into helping the industry kind of?
Sure. So in 2008, I wrote the Professional Barista's Handbook. I did not write it with the expectation that it would sell many copies or make money or anything like that. I just wrote it because I was doing nothing and I kept thinking, God, I wish I had a book like that when I was starting out. And I thought of it as kind of a service more than a business venture. And the book did well, it sold well. And I was pleasantly surprised. And I kind of enjoyed the process of writing a book. And certainly, being my first book, I made a lot of mistakes. I made the process a lot harder than it could have been. And then once I had a team of people involved in the book creation process, I felt like I could write another book and it would be a lot easier and a lot quicker and less pain. And I got into that. And then people would read the book and they would email me and ask me questions. And that was sort of became a flood of questions, let's just say. And it just came natural that I would start doing some consulting. And I started consulting right after the book came out because I got a lot of questions. And then one day, a couple of years later, my friend Sam in Sydney, Australia, suggested that I do a seminar. And I thought, okay, why not? And Sam offered his cafe as a venue for me, and he offered to help market it. And Sam accidentally, got me started on a very successful seminar career where,
Accidentally.
if I, every time I come to Australia, I put on one or two or three seminars, and it's profitable. It's a nice way to connect with everyone, a nice way to share what I've learned in the last couple of years. And I tend to do that in most parts of the world wherever I'm going to consult. Yeah.
That's awesome to
Very
hear.
cool. At what point had you always kind of wanted to write a book or be an
No, not at
author?
all. Not at all. I mean, I'm a competent writer, but I was also the kid in high school who dreaded every writing assignment, right? I was a math nerd, and I just was like, oh, these are so painful. And I never saw myself as a writer. But I've learned for sure that if you really know a subject well, it's not that difficult to write about
Mm-hmm.
it, right? If you
Yeah,
said,
yeah.
hey, Scott, write a novel or write a poem, I'll fail miserably. But if you say, hey, write about the gut microbiome, write about coffee roasting, write about finance, like these are things that I've, studied hard and been interested in a long time. I feel like I could write competently about them. And not because I'm a writer, just because it's just a form of communication
Yeah.
about something you already know
Gotcha.
about.
100%. All right. Well, now that we kind of got a large part of your career in, I think starting to ask questions more on the home enthusiast side of thing. I was reading on your blog a little bit, like getting ready for this episode, and you talk about, I would love to hear your kind of take on how us home enthusiasts like should go about. I'd love to hear your take on kind of in this new wave of coffee you hear, transparency and sustainability a lot. I would kind of love to hear your take on those things. And with after that opening prodigal and kind of like what your aims with prodigal are.
Sure. Sustainability is probably one of the most abused words in the world right now. So many things are claimed to be sustainable if someone's simply greenwashing or doing something that sounds more environmentally friendly than the next option. But it's very questionable. I mean, it's even questionable whether high quality coffee is inherently sustainable over the next 50 years, right? Who knows, right? We don't really know with climate change and whatnot. So I think sustainable is in the eye of the beholder, and certainly time will tell what is and isn't sustainable. Transparency, I think most people who throw that word around mean well. I think that some people have extreme political motives when it comes to transparency in terms of trying to do like a gotcha type situation with other people. Some people want to be transparent simply because they really genuinely do want to share their business practices, show that they've got ethical practices, maybe make normalize certain high prices or things like that. Who knows? Everyone's got their different motives. I think that there's a little naivete around transparency in the sense that, like, I've seen a few roasters put out their transparency reports, and it's great. It's great that they do it, but at the end of the day, that 90-something percent of people reading those reports don't know whether, let's say, $6 a pound at the farm level is good or bad, right? And they don't necessarily know how to interpret the numbers. So I've seen some transparency reports that laid it out really well, where there's really no ambiguity around things. And there were some where I just looked at it being like, it seems transparent, but it's not actually telling you anything that you really need to know if you want to dive in and evaluate someone's practices. So take it as it comes. Prodigal's goal really is just, okay, there's more than one goal, but over the years, if I were to buy a bag of coffee from 10 well-known roasters, and I were to take those 10 bags, I would probably be somewhat disappointed in 7 out of those 10 bags for one reason or another, whether it's roasting, green, staleness, baking, underdevelopment, or whatever it is. And I got a little frustrated to the point where I thought, I've basically invented how to be uber consistent as a roaster. And I both wanted to demonstrate that and also provide a roastery where we will literally never let our customers down. Like, we do not put out subpar coffee. We do not put out roasts that miss the mark by a little bit. And no one's like that. Everyone puts out stuff that they know they missed, and they just don't want to lose money on it. And I wanted to do things a little bit different. That's what we do. We just want to be the most reliable roaster in the world as much as we can be.
So is that something
Yeah,
that you
awesome.
kind of had an itch to do, or was it a combination between you and Mark, and you guys met off of consulting, or can you talk a little about
Yeah.
that?
So Mark hired me about 12 years ago to consult for him. We became friends, ended up talking about coffee pretty regularly over the years. He had a roasting business in his garage, literally in San Francisco. All San Francisco businesses start in garages,
Yeah,
right?
I was about to say, I
And
feel like that's pretty common.
when
It's
the
trendy.
pandemic hit, all of his customers who were all tech offices, they all went to remote work, and so he lost most of his business over a very, very short period of time. So I said to him, "Let's just pack up, get out of San Francisco, let's chill for a year or two till this thing blows over, and then let's figure out where we want to go, and we'll open a roastery together." And we did. We went to Boulder, Colorado, and we opened a roastery there. I mean, we have the same values when it comes to quality. We have very similar taste when it comes to coffee. We've cupped maybe 10,000 coffees together, so we're very, very well calibrated. We have the same goal, which is to be uber consistent. We just never want to let anyone down. We don't want to slide into mediocrity. We don't want success to allow us to kind of rest on our elbows and just say, "Oh, it's okay if only 50% of the coffees going out the door are really actually good." Like, we just want to be good every single time.
I think from my experience as a consumer, I've felt that way with every single product of coffee I've gotten. And going back to
Absolutely.
what you were kind of talking about with the Fortacana and how with Prodigal you don't really source any coffees that come off funky or boozy or too much. Speaking about that, I feel like recently with my own personal palate, I've kind of gravitated towards that kind of profile of coffee. And talking about the kind of trends of where the industry is going with the co-ferments and boozy coffee, I would love to hear your kind of take on the fourth wave of coffee.
Is it the fourth wave?
Yeah, exactly.
It's been a lot of fourth waves.
Yeah, or whatever it is.
Look, first, I want to say whatever someone personally likes, that's great. That is totally good for you. Awesome. I have no concern over, everyone's got their own personal preferences, and that's always fine, right? Some people tend to take it personally. If I say something like, "I don't like boozy naturals," people be like, "I hate you," and I'm like, oh, okay, that's
You're like,
weird.
oh, right, cool.
But I think ultimately co-ferments and all of the sort of outlier things that happen in coffee, they're good and bad. They're good insofar as they're gateways for a lot of people who may not appreciate what others might call sort of straightforward, boring, pretty wash coffees, right? They're not, a lot of times the kind of coffees that I love are not jazzy enough for certain consumers, right? And if those bombastic coffees get people interested in specialty coffee and into flavor notes and away from, say, Starbucks or something else, like that's great. Like that's a bridge. And I'm pretty confident when I say that very, very few consumers stay at that level of wanting extreme flavors in coffee. It's usually a stepping stone, not a permanent plateau, right? So most people get a little tired of it after a while and then start appreciating more subtlety. But you got to start somewhere, right? Whether you're coming from dark roasts or something else, whatever it is that moves you towards more selective, high quality, specialty coffee is great. And everyone's at a different place on that journey. Everyone will also perhaps stop at a different place in the sense that they'll be satisfied with a certain style and that may never change again. And then other people are kind of always changing. And so I don't want the co-ferment thing to get so big that it becomes the norm, because I feel like it kind of takes away a little bit of the craft or a little bit of the, for lack of a better word, the terroir or the whatever specialness of a time and place and process that goes into making some subtle coffees very beautiful. But I would like to think it's going to be a little sideshow that if anything gets more people into specialties, so that's not a bad thing.
Gotcha. And then
And
also, sorry, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
just to add one thing to it, and on the producer side, I mean, if you're familiar with Diego Bermudez, right? Diego
Oh, yeah.
years ago recognized that he could buy a whole bunch of Castillo cherry at very low prices because Castillo is not highly praised or valued by the market. And Diego could use creative processing to add a lot of value to that Castillo. And Diego did very well for himself by arbitraging the low cost of the Castillo and the high price he could get by adding kind of like a heavy-handed processing to make very interesting flavors for the Castillo. And I would say co-ferments are doing a very similar thing for a lot of farmers. They can take a not so great raw bean or, in cherry form, and they can process it and add, some sort of infused whatever to add value. And for them, it's a win financially. And then we've already talked about the consumer side, how it's not necessarily a bad thing if it brings people into the fold.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, that's really interesting. Yeah, that's awesome. It's like the first
Yeah,
coffee
I
I had
mean,
from Diego Bermudez was that Castillo.
yeah, that thermal shock, it's nuts. But it is one of those things that's like it makes you go, wow, what is this? Why is this? How can I experience this again?
And the raw materials that went into it are actually quite cheap. So it's, he's doing a little wizardry with relatively affordable material. And so he's done well for himself by seeing, oh, okay, there's this mismatch. Like I can get this pretty cheaply. I could put it through this process and charge a lot for it. And he's an excellent businessman.
100%.
Yeah.
Started a
So
wave.
you've definitely seen the industry grow and change and shift in many different ways. And we oftentimes have the conversation of what is the fourth wave? When is the fourth wave? And we talk about coffee and the industry in this timeline of waves. Do you think that we're close to a fourth wave? We're in a fourth wave?
Is it the
Or
sixth wave?
the filter 5.4 wave.
I don't. I don't. I mean, the first wave was basically commodity junkie coffee. The second wave was basically dark roasts, coffee not really being differentiated by, place and variety, etc. And basically, the second wave was just business. It was big companies selling, a lot of coffee at low prices. It was all about business. Third wave was this movement toward both business and uniqueness of coffee, and lighter roasts happened, and green quality tended to overall go up a lot during this time. I don't think there's been any seismic shift that would demand that we call it now a fourth wave. I mean, there's always these claims of like, oh, we're fourth wave or whatever. I don't see that at all. I don't know what will make it the fourth wave if and when it happens, but I don't think we're there yet.
Interesting.
Gotcha. And then do you also think that the conversation of talking about the industry in waves is a com is the way we should talk about it? Or should we be not judging the industry based on its advancements and kind of just really focusing on just the quality itself and like really not focusing on are we in this waves?
I don't think it matters very much. I mean, the one value I see in talking about third wave is that third wave differentiates different types of specialty companies. I mean, Starbucks is specialty, but they're not third wave, right? And Prodigal, let's say, is third wave, but it's and of course specialty, but very different than Starbucks, right? And so that at least helps a little bit. When you say third wave, you think, oh, okay, I know they're talking about it's a lighter roast, it's higher quality green than just any old specialty, right? But I don't think it matters too much, to be honest. I mean, no one's and if you say second wave and you mean Starbucks, Second Cup, all those kind of companies, that's fine. But it's not. I just don't see it as that important of conversation.
For kind of continuing this conversation on coffee roasters, for a person working as a coffee roaster, do you think it is important to like just focus on your own roast and improving it, or tasting as many different coffees from different roasters as you can? Like, what do you think that is important to do, like blind cuppings with
Right.
different roasters around you and stuff like that?
I mean, most of your effort, of course, should be focusing on your own roasts and improving them. But I would say at least once a week, you should have other roasters' coffee on the table blindly mixed up, so you have no idea where they are. Ideally, you don't even know when they're on the table, right? In other words, if Mark sets up a cupping, I don't ask Mark what's in today's cupping. And if I set up a cupping, Mark doesn't ask me what's in today's cupping. And if there's 15 bowls on the table, for all I know, there's a few curve balls in there. So all those things are really important to avoid bias, right? If you think everything on the table is my roasts and you want to be sort of, let's say, too proud of your roasts, like, oh, I know they're all going to be great, whatever, like you'll be a little biased in a way, right? But if you have no idea what's on the table, you have to be kind of ready for anything. You just taste with a blank slate, truly, and an open mind. That's really optimal.
I think for something that I just got an email about actually was the Prodigal releasing the roast defect kit and the coffee scoring kit. Seeing that, I think is awesome. Do you think it's really important for people to like go about learning about tasting under development, or and as Prodigal, like how do you go for creating this kind of kit and like doing an underdeveloped dose or doing a overdeveloped or that sort of thing?
So for us, underdeveloped would be a color number above a certain threshold.
Okay.
Of course, some people disagree, course, some people really like the flavors that I would call underdeveloped. Like I would say if a coffee is, if it has a lot of hay or grass or corn or like a peas or beans type flavor, to me, it's underdeveloped. Someone else might say, yeah, but I love that. And that's totally fine, of course.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's almost an objective line where the color numbers above that line, things are going to taste like hay, grass, corn, whatnot. And then below that line, there's going to be more fruit with all of those sort of slightly vegetal flavors. And I would like to say that that's where you go from underdeveloped to developed, but of course that's just my opinion.
For the home, and I think I do struggle with this sometimes. It's like knowing, once I go through a coffee, it's like knowing what would be your recommendation for someone who's getting into choosing coffee to drink, and kind of like an approach to good roasters. It's like, how do I know, looking at this website, looking at their lineup, would you say, just kind of your personal preference, if I know I liked Wash Brews and they have a Wash Brew, should I go for that? Or how do I, looking at a roaster's website, how would you kind of advise, like who to choose from, or is there a right or wrong roasting style, prefering sweetness or more fruit forward coffees or things like that?
Yeah,
Some
I mean,
roaster red
certainly
flags.
roaster
Roaster
red.
red flags.
So
Roaster
there's
red
certainly
flags.
no right or wrong style. I don't think you can tell from looking at someone's website whether the roasting is done well or not. That's always going to be a little bit of a risk. I would say that if I'll give you for an example, like a company like say releases one or two or three coffees every week. We release one sometimes two coffees every week. At least in a situation like that, you know the green is fresh.
Yes.
So if you go to a company that's putting out new green on a regular basis, that can give you confidence that at least you're buying something that the green is very fresh. Okay, that's a huge win right there because you don't want to go to some random website, buy a coffee and realize, oh, that green is a year old and it kind of tastes a little baggy and a little boring. So that's number one. Number two, I wouldn't overweight this, but if there's decent information about the coffee, where is it from? What does it taste like? What's, maybe what's the farmer's name? What's the variety? Blah, blah, blah. That's good. If it just says something like Christmas blend, usually not so great. Not to say it couldn't be good, but it's just a little riskier. Okay. And beyond that, I mean, I think the way people talk about their coffee might give you some green flags or red flags. But you'd have to be a little practiced in that, and it'd be hard for me to say what exact words are good and bad. But you would, if you read enough websites, you get kind of get an idea of who's just fluff and who's actually got information and focus, right?
Interesting.
Going.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No,
No, you're all good,
you
man.
go ahead, Lewis.
Nope,
No,
nope,
okay.
nope.
No, all right. So going on, looking at the industry as a whole and its current state, what do you think are some things that we're doing really well as an industry and things that we can work on? Where do we need to put our focus in such a very big, kind of oversaturated market industry?
So I don't know that it's oversaturated. I mean, I've been places in the world where people are like, ah, it's saturated, and then it just keeps growing, right? And so, I think it's only saturated when you see companies going out of business regularly. Then you can say it's oversaturated. But I think by definition, if we're all surviving and growing, then it's not oversaturated. I mean, the market itself is growing as well. So, I would say we're still not that great at welcoming and making people feel comfortable when they're not already light roast third wave type consumers, right? The Starbucks customer, your grandma, et cetera, like we're not the best at communicating with those people, making them feel comfortable and giving them a reason to try it. We sometimes, at least in the US, more so than other places, sometimes we're a little snobby about the way we speak to consumers. And there's nothing wrong with having extremely high standards for what you do, but when you're speaking to consumers, you really want to kind of meet them where they're at to a degree, make them feel comfortable. And we're not always so great at that.
100%. I agree.
Yeah.
With I would love to get your opinion on for the home brewer and, someone that is interested in coffee, and especially nowadays with kind of the social media aspect of the coffee industry, people flashing their different gadgets that they have or saying, you need this if you want to make good espresso. What kind of advice would you give someone who is looking to, I guess, step up their home coffee game? And would you, because I know on your website you offer a bunch of different tools and like brewers and stuff. What would you kind of like, what advice do you have to someone that's looking into specialty nowadays?
So, first of all, I think the goal is to make success more likely and make coffee a little bit easier, right? I love to say that there's no points for difficulty in coffee, right? Making it difficult to achieve a really good cup doesn't make sense, right? So this is why, for instance, like when I sell stuff, I sell the Hoop and I sell the Pulsar. I don't sell any other brewers simply because those are the two best brewers that make success almost automatic. And it's a reason why I don't sell Kalitas and V60s. And it's not that you can't make a good coffee with those things, but let's face it, if I go to a cafe and there's a V60 and the barista is going to make me V60, there's a 50-50 chance it's not going to be good. And I'm being nice. Okay. So, but I mean, I could teach anyone in the world how to make a hoop that's going to be good in 10 seconds. Okay. So I really like to focus on things that promote success, right? That's why I like to sell the spray heads for the FETCO and the Curtis, that kind of thing, right? I would say number one, use good water, right? And what makes good water? The number one thing is that your bicarbonate, or also known as the alkalinity or the buffer or the HCO3 on that little nutrition label, the bicarbonate should be, say, 25 to 40 parts per million or milligrams per liter. And that will control the acidity of the coffee and put you in kind of the sweet spot. And if you're lucky, your tap water is somewhere near there. Fantastic. If not, go find some bottled water or get distilled water and get something like Lotus Drops or something and add minerals to your water, right? You need good water to not suppress the acidity or such. Number two, the grinder is by far the most important piece of equipment as far as making high quality coffee. Especially if you are making espresso, grind quality is kind of everything. I'd rather have a really great grinder and a cheap espresso machine than vice versa. Okay. And number three, if you're going to make filter coffee at home, which is a lot easier to do well than espresso, buy something like, Hoop, Pulsar, something that can make really good coffee really easily. I would say, it's not as good, but the like the Switch or the Clever are in that category too, where it's like it takes no skill. It's pretty damn easy. Okay.
100%.
Those are the biggies, right? Most people are not using good water. They're using a device that takes an incredible amount of skill and attention and time to make the coffee good, and they're still not succeeding that often.
Yeah, I've seen I agree, and I think it's frustrating seeing like the amount of kind of like weird ads that are on Instagram where it's like someone flexing their coffee setup and saying you need this, but it's like they got sent everything that they're showing, and it just confuses people a lot when it's like, do I need
I mean,
eight espresso tools or
all
whatever?
right. So the single best piece of advice I could give anyone when it comes to dealing with the internet is focus on very, very few people and ignore everyone else, right? Like if James Salzman says something about coffee, it's true, right? James is very smart, knows what he's talking about, right? Lance gets extremely into detail about a lot of things. If you've got the bandwidth and you really want to go down the rabbit hole, trust Lance. Lance really knows what he's talking about, right? I'm not going to say something online unless I'm pretty damn certain it's true. Okay. If you can find those people who are making sense, who have a lot of experience, and if you can just ignore the noise that's in forums and everywhere else, you're not missing anything. I promise. I promise that if something's really important out there, one of us is going to say it at some point. Okay, so you don't need to be promiscuous and read everything and absorb an enormous amount of information, because if you don't have a tremendous amount of experience, you will not know how to filter out the misinformation. And the problem is, once you absorb misinformation, you don't know it's misinformation. And then it takes a lot of experience to unwind that.
Yeah.
And it's better, instead of taking two steps forward, one step back by reading a bunch of crap, it's better to just take one gentle step forward very carefully every day, right? You'll make nothing but forward progress. And really, you could do that by ignoring 99% of what's out there and just trusting a few people who actually have a lot of experience and knowledge.
I think that's really awesome advice. And
Perfect. Yep.
yeah. So kind of getting towards the end of this episode here, I'd love to talk about what kind of is next for Scott Rao, and what kind of you would like to do in these next couple of years, and what your goal is, and even if what you would love to see the industry do in these next couple of years.
Yeah. So I don't really know what I'm gonna do next. Starting Prodigal was, took some time and effort. Now that's going well. This year, Jonathan Gagné is gonna finish a book about espresso, and I'm gonna publish that for him. So I'm very excited for
That's
that.
super exciting.
Um, oh yeah.
Uh-oh.
I think I'm gonna do a lot more travel for green buying this year. So I'm gonna try to buy. As we grow, our green buying needs at Prodigal are the most important thing, and I'm going to have to do some travel to take care of that. Got a bunch of seminars coming up, but yeah, don't know exactly. I'm kind of thinking about like what the next project is, and what would be interesting. And but there's I'm also trying not to put too much pressure myself. I'm trying to just
Just
take a
relax,
little bit of a
relax it.
semi break and enjoy things along the way, and then see what comes up. So
100%,
yeah, you've
man.
done a lot. You've done. You need your break.
I'm getting old. I need to slow down. So, you know.
No, hey, we didn't say that. We didn't say that.
I
That's
did.
not.
I did. It's true. It's true.
So I guess getting to the end here, like going back a little bit to green buying, that's something that getting a little nerdy here. What are some like best practices or practices at Prodigal that you guys have that you believe every roaster should maintain and become part of their focus as a roaster in green buying?
So it's hard to say what every roaster should do, because a lot of people have different missions when it comes to green buying, right? They might be supporting a certain type of producer. They might have a certain angle on things. I mean, look, not every roaster is obviously choosing green purely based on quality, because not everybody is aiming for the 88s of the world. Like some companies live quite happily in the 80 to 82 range, right? That's their business, right? And that's totally appropriate, because most of the world's coffee is, of slightly lower quality, and as the quality goes up, the amount of coffee available, that quality decreases. So basically, your business model, whoever you are, says something like, ah, we buy coffee at, 80, 82. We buy low grade specialty coffee, and we do our best with it, et cetera, But I think, as far as people trying to buy very good green, cupping blindly is essential. I still see a lot of roasters cupping but not having it be blind. And if it's not blind, that might be a bit of a crutch, and you might be cheating a bit, and you might trust yourself too much, in the sense that we all have biases. Even if you have a tray of roasted coffee sitting there next to the cupping bowl, and it doesn't have a note to say what the name of the coffee is, you might look at those beans and still be biased by them. Right? Our subconscious doing all things to us. Okay, so cupping blindly, controlling the quality of your sample roasts is something that I think is not done well enough or often enough. In other words, most roasters will put something in the sample roaster, they'll get out a semi-arbitrary roast color, and they'll cup it, and they'll make a buying decision based on that, but the sample roast isn't always on point, and the roast quality can easily influence which grain you buy. But it shouldn't. Like, ideally, you're always roasting to exactly the same color before you make your green buying decisions. Other than that, I mean, it's very hard to generalize, because so many roasters are buying Some roasters are buying based on, forward contracts, and they're moving whole containers of relatively low quality greens. Some roasters are buying spots. Some, it's a, everyone's got a different paradigm they're living under, so it's hard to generalize.
Gotcha. Yeah, and then I think really the only thing that I have is the getting to the end, just some fun questions. You travel around the world a lot. What are some of your favorite cafes that you visited around the world?
Oh wow. Okay. Now this is not a definitive list because I'm sure as soon as we get off, I'll think, oh, I forgot this cafe. So I apologize to anyone I forget. So I'm in Melbourne right now. Melbourne's an incredible city for coffee. It's really enjoyable. Like there's so much enthusiasm for coffee here. Yesterday I did a brewing event at a place called Calaire, which is a tiny cafe run by some lovely Asian women who have fun every single minute that they're brewing coffee, and they really care about quality. It's a great place. I had a lovely coffee experience yesterday at Patricia, which is a very successful coffee bar in Melbourne. Those places are great. One of my favorite cafes in the entire world is in Prague. It's called Mušalek Kávy, and my cup of coffee. And they do something that really only the Australians generally do well, which is good hospitality, good coffee, good food, all in one really nice cafe. It's a lovely place. It's run by Double Shot, the roaster. Let's see what else. I had a really great experience in Sydney last week at a place called Stitch. It's owned by my friend Noir, who owns also the co-roasting place in Sydney. It's a beautiful place. And the food was great, the coffee was great, and they had a really nice menu of like cig drink type coffee cocktails, no booze, just coffee, concoctions that were oh really delicious. That was
Nice.
really good to see. Yeah, so those are a few. I mean, in the US, every time I'm in New York, I go straight to Suited, which is where we met.
That place.
And Suited is just so solid. Andrew knows what he's doing. He runs it like a professional. And the food will be good, the coffee will be good every time you go there.
Yeah, he's all right. He'll be listening, so I can't hype him up too much. So just kidding. Andrew, you're
hearing you
great.
talk about it with the hospitality side of things, I feel like, sorry, Siri, just started freaking out. I think that's something that is looked over a lot with the specialty coffee. A lot of people focus on their coffee and not how they treat their customers or that side of things. So, do you think that is important for roasters? Like, I mean, even you just speaking about opening your first cafe and bonding with the hometown customers. I feel like with cafes, is that like a huge kind of thing that you're looking for every single time you step into a cafe? It's just kind of like the hospitality side of things.
Yes. I would rather go to a place that treats me well and makes me feel happy and comfortable than a place with slightly better coffee that doesn't do that. It's
Boom.
definitely it's often a forgotten piece of the coffee business, more so in the US than other places. There's definitely I've had some experiences in US cafes where there's a little bit of snobbery, a little bit of coldness, and it seems to come from the sort of attitude of like, well, we're better than you because we are so good at coffee and you're just a consumer kind of thing. And it's like, there's just no place for that in hospitality.
100%. Yeah,
No,
100%.
and to be honest, you hear the word hospitality thrown around as a profession, as an aspiration in a place like Australia. You don't really hear it that much in the US. I've had okay, I'll tell you a story if you got time for a story.
Oh, we got time.
Oh, we got plenty of time
We
here.
got time.
It's a bad story. I'm not going to name names. I'm just going to tell you the story. Okay. So this was about 15 years ago. I went to a what was probably the most famous trendy cafe in the US at the time. And I went with a guy who I considered to have probably the best palate in the whole world when it comes to coffee buying, right? Okay. So there was a, this is a long time ago, there was a $12 cup of Panama coffee on offer, made by the cup. And so we ordered that. The barista made it, took his sweet time. Like you could tell he was taking his time in the whole I'm proving to you I have no hurry. I have no, urgency here. I'm gonna, it was intentional, right? And so he makes the coffee. The coffee gets, we're about to sip the coffee, and my friends and I both look at each other like, and I turned to the barista and I said, I'm sorry, this isn't good. He's like, what do you mean it's not good? It's the Panama, blah, blah, blah. It's amazing, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, yeah, but it smells rancid. He's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, I've never done this before or since in my entire 30-year career. But I was like, do you want to know why it's bad? He's like, yeah. And I told him all the like every single thing that went wrong, like in the roasting, in the brewing, and they basically were reusing a cloth filter that was rancid,
Oh,
right?
gosh.
And after I got done telling him this, he says to me, oh, if I knew you knew more than me, I would have just made you another one. And it was one of those moments where I'm like, is that what's going on here? Is it
That's insane.
a mine is bigger than yours sort of
Yeah.
competition, right? And it was such a weird thing for someone in hospitality to say,
Yeah,
but it
wait, did that?
explained.
Did you really just say that?
I
That's
can't believe
wow. I
that.
mean, it's like he said the quiet part out loud, and you're like, that's what's going on here. And I mean, so anyway, obviously that's an extreme version of something, but when you got the balls to put out a $20 cup of coffee 15 years ago, which is like a $25 cup of coffee now, you stand by it, right? If I sell a $100 bag of coffee, which I haven't yet, but if I did, and someone complains and says, I don't really like it, it's blah, 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 I'll be like, cool, I'll give you your money back. I'm really sorry, or I'll send you another one if you want to try it again. But it's like, you don't your responsibility as a business doesn't stop as soon as the price goes to a certain level, or as soon as you feel like you're amazing, you're still in the customer service business. So to me, the hospitality part is should be number one in terms of, everything's about people, right? You're making coffee because you want to make people happy, with something delicious that makes their day, right? And we drink coffee because it makes us happy, and it's a wonderful experience. It's an affordable luxury. Right. And the people we buy coffee from, like by and large, are just such lovely people that we have such a nice relationship and with, and we feel the same way about the customers, right? It's like I mean, life is so hollow without these human connections, right? I mean, I can make money sitting at my laptop emailing clients all day long, but it's kind of boring and it's kind of lacking that human connection that makes things enjoyable in a special way, right? And when you own a cafe and you're in daily interaction with all these people, like rather than being annoyed that you have to work hard or kind of do all these things, it's like it's an incredible opportunity to connect with people and feel a part of community and feel the benefit of what you're doing for them. And there's this, lovely give and take. I mean, I'm still friendly and in touch with people who worked for me and people who drank my coffee 30 years ago at that first cafe, right? And that's to me, that's incredibly special. And I care much more about that, and my memories come much more from the people than from the coffee, right?
100%. And I think that's something that the I guess the chain of coffee is something that I've fallen in love with, and I know probably for Caleb too. It's just like being able to represent that and work in that is awesome. And speaking on what you just mentioned is, even us, I recently was in New York, and we went to some of the biggest roasteries in the US, and my favorite experiences were at like the smaller places that were at my hospitality I felt was better. And so I think that speaks a lot. And especially, speaking on the US, I feel like it is lacking, and you do get that, oh, well, if I knew that you knew more than me kind of attitude a little bit more than often.
Yeah, that's it's also there's speaking of stories, there's one story that I've heard you tell that I would love to hear you say again, just for the podcast, just because people listening, if they're not sold on Prodigal, I mean, Prodigal's fantastic, and I think this story speaks volumes on your character and just Prodigal as a whole. And the first coffee release of Prodigal and what happened there? Just love to hear you tell that story again.
I don't know if it was the very first release, but Right near the beginning, we were borrowing someone else's machine and facility, and there were some compromises that we had to make. And there was a coffee that just, in the end, we put it out, and I kept tasting it day after day, and I thought, this coffee wasn't, I'm not happy with this coffee. Like I was not happy that we sold it. I was not happy with the way it came out. It didn't get better with rest to the point where I was happy with it. And so I just unilaterally, and I just announced to our customers, I was like, "Look, we're refunding everyone, and we refunded $25,000 worth of coffee." No one had complained, but I just felt like, I've said we have a certain standard, we're sticking to it, and to his credit, also my partner Mark, he was on board. Like, I'm sure he wasn't happy about it, but it was, we both felt like we need to be clear that we have our internal standard and we're not breaking it for the sake of money. And it hurt. We were a new company. We weren't really making any money yet. Set us back financially, but it was absolutely what, and of course you get 9 out of 10 people are like, "Thank you, I appreciate that. Wasn't necessary. I like the coffee, but nice job." And then you get 1 out of 10 people saying, "Oh, I see you're beta testing on your customers. You suck." And it's like, I'm like, thank you
Beta
anyway.
testing is crazy.
I know. And I'm like, okay,
That's
look,
nuts.
that's the internet though. But
Gotta love
I mean,
it.
it was, I mean, I would like to think that the average person thought, okay, maybe you're a little nuts, but I appreciate that, and you've got some integrity, and we respect that, and we also trust you now more. So
100%.
hopefully.
I think a lot more businesses need that. That's a really cool story. But
And
yeah.
to be clear, it probably will never happen again, where our quality control methods are much tighter now. But if it happens and it costs me more, fine. Like,
Yeah.
it's not that I'm super rich. It's just more like I did not start this business to get rich. I started this business to make a statement that a roaster can be uber consistent and also incredibly, reliable in every sense. And I want the trust that comes along with that.
Yeah, and I feel like, especially for the nerds out there, and I speak to my friend about this a lot because he'll mention to me, he'll be like, dude, just like you just need to make the most amount of money or like do this thing and talking about for me like wanting to go into coffee or wanting to open a business, it's like no, like I want to stay true to me and my morals and the kind of like what hospitality kind of runs on, and using the hospitality word again, but it's like the trust that you have with the people that you're serving or the kind of displaying yourself to other people and serving them whatever you're offering. I feel like you have to be true to yourself. You have to be trustworthy. You have to have all of that in order to establish a connection and or a relationship with whatever your customer bias is or anything like that. I feel like
I mean,
that.
I would like to think we will never do things short term, and we will never do things transactionally. We will always do things thinking of the long run and thinking of the relationships that are involved. That's our goal anyway. And I think, it's hard, especially when you're younger. It's very hard to think that way. It's very hard to trust the future in a sense. But like, whether it's business success, whether it's wealth, anything else, like, it's really the compounding of good decisions and waiting a long time, for those things to compound and grow in your favor is how you do well in life. And I'll never want to, grab a buck short term and ding my reputation long term, right? That kind of thing.
Well, sweet.
Yeah.
You got
Yeah,
kind
well,
of anything else you want to ask, Caleb?
I no, I think I'm yeah, I got everything covered.
All right.
You?
No, I'm all good. Anything that you
Scott?
want to say at the end of this episode, Scott?
No. I think we covered some good ground. I
Yeah.
appreciate you having me here.
Of course, yeah. Thank you so
Yeah,
much.
we appreciate you coming on. This is genuinely something we didn't think we'd be doing a year into this. So it's fantastic, and thank you, thank you.
Right.
If you guys liked what you listened to, though, go check out scottrao.com.
Yeah,
And
sure.com.
where is Scott Rao on Instagram? And Prodigal
I
Coffee,
think it's
get Prodigal
get
Coffee.
prodigal, get
Yeah,
prodigal.
get Prodigal Coffee.
Yeah. All righty. Well,
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you,
finish off
guys.
this episode. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.